He kōna ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
No mai, haere mai. It's good to be with you this week for another edition of Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today we're with an adventurous couple going back to the basics in the bush, and they're loving it.
Woolen shopping bags can keep your groceries cold, so we're off to a farm deep in Rangitike to meet the farmers producing the bags and a range of other accessories made from their clip.
And we're spending time with a young farmer with 4,000 deer.
But before we meet this week's guest, last week, Saturday's edition of Country Life didn't make it to air because of a special program devoted to Prince Philip. If you missed hearing Country Life, the stories, and they were crackers last week, are available online.
Anyway, back to the task at hand. Cosmo's in North Canterbury now with Steve Day to find out about a tractor adventure raising money for a good cause.
We're a group of people that formed an organisation called the Heartland Tractor Trek. We're in outside the Super Cheap Auto premises in Rangiora, where we've just conducted the starting formalities for the Heartland Tractor Trek. That's going to take us down to Timaru this evening. Then we head on down to Outram near Dunedin, across to Ranfurly, Cromwell, then to Wanaka, to Wheels at Wanaka for 3 days. Then we head up to near Twizel, Geraldine, and then back up here to Rangiora.
And what's the story behind this tractor trek?
The story behind it is that my wife and I are heart kid grandparents to Oliver. Oliver will be 2 in May. He's been through the process of being in Starship, and now he's back out into the community, being supported very well by Heart Kids New Zealand. This was set up so it was an opportunity for us to give back to the organisations that support these Heart Kids and Heart Kids New Zealand.
Yes, yes, and so it sounds like Oliver's doing really well.
Yes, he is. He's a dear little guy, and very special to us, and as any grandchild is, but even more special after what he's been through. For example, he had 3 heart operations before he was 6 months old. There's 12 heart kids born per week in New Zealand, and they are the largest sector group user of Starship's facilities.
And how much money are you hoping to raise?
Well, it's always a difficult thing to target this, but Heart Kids New Zealand felt that we should be capable of gaining enough funding for around $75,000. We've already got $48,000 in the bank, basically, before we started. So we're quietly optimistic. We may even be fortunate enough to double that.
Where are you from, Steve?
I'm from New Plymouth in Taranaki. So 3 tractors have driven down. We've done the 750-kilometre trip from New Plymouth down to Rangiora, and then we've joined up here with another 5 tractors that are carrying on from here.
Now, these are all Chamberlain tractors that really do stand out because they're all orange.
Yes, they're all 1960s Chamberlain tractors of various different models. They were developed in Western Australia for broadacre cultivation. One of the things that appeals to us about them is that they're capable of quite a good road speed, so we're sitting at about 40 kilometres an hour on the open road. And they're also, they've got a double seat and a cab, so they've got all the luxuries, really.
Yes, and along the way you did have a wee accident. Tell me about that.
Unfortunately, up just south of Levin, I was well off the road and was hit by a logging truck that could have given a lot more room than what he did. Fortunately, the good folks at Rod Clifton Motors launched into business and helped out straighten out the rim that was severely bent, and I managed to keep going and just catch the ferry.
Nothing is going to stop you from doing this trek, Steve.
No, we've come too far. We've been planning this for nearly 18 months, and now it's all about doing what we set out to do, and that's just help the Heart Kids.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and if I could just say, if anyone wishes to donate, we'd be very grateful if they would go to heartlandtractortrek.nz, where they can donate. Even the cost of a coffee would be very, very welcome. Thank you.
Steve Day.
And now to our look around the country. There's been a bit of rain to freshen things up in Northland. The feed situation is just average, though. There have been a lot of farm sales in the district. Even farms that have been on the market for a while are changing hands. The bigger ones are staying in dairy. But our contact says buyers are diversifying into vegetables, forestry and even peanut growing. Around Pukekohe, there's been rapid growth in crops with warm days prevailing. But lettuce growers are not amused by their crops failing to develop tight hearts. Midweek, the weather turned and a cold front delivered heavy rainfall with lower temperatures. Storage sheds are full of large-sized onions. The smaller ones have been heading to an uncertain European market.
It's been hot and humid in Waikato. Some areas are struggling to get enough rain. The ground just swallows up what falls. A farmer near Te Awamutu got 70 millimetres, but he wonders where it went. He's feeding out maize and grass silage. Dairy farmers are winding down for the season, starting to dry off cows, doing maintenance and encouraging staff to take some time off before calving. Milk production has been better than last year. A farmer in Western Bay of Plenty had about 40 millimetres of rain this week, but one creek's gone dry for the first time in a century, a product, perhaps, of below-average rainfall over the last 2 years. Milk production is 30% ahead of last year, which wasn't great because of the dry. The Brix, or sugar, levels have been slow to come up in the kiwifruit orchard this year, perhaps a function of warm days and not enough cold nights. With 180 million trays to pick over a more compressed time frame, one grower fears a bit of a train smash in a couple of weeks.
It's been a pick and mix of weather in Taranaki this week. Rain, wind, sun and even a bit of thunder and a slight dusting of snow on the mountain one day. Most dairy farms have plenty of feed so they can milk into May. It's much drier than this time last year on the east coast. There's only been a skiff of rain this week, which is making a lot of people nervous. They are holding cattle, hoping for the market to lift. The feed situation is starting to bite as farmers head into winter. Rams are out and farmers are trying to keep the ewes well fed. Despite the dry, most stock are still in pretty good condition.
In Hawke's Bay, there are good tallies coming off apple orchards where there's skilled labour. Some keen pickers can pick 7 or 8 bins a day, at about $40 a bin, whereas less enthusiastic pickers only fill a bin and a half. Picking conditions have been fabulous with fine windless days. The Fuji harvest is winding down and Pink Lady and Envy are still coming off the trees. One of our Manawatu contacts was busy competing at the local dog trials when we called. She says the area's had rain this week. Cows have scanned pretty well. There was so much grass they had few excuses for not getting in calf. Now the rams are out. Wairarapa has had fine settled weather and about 5 millimetres of rain after good rain the previous week. Temperatures have been in the 20s and contractors have been hard out regrassing. Dairy farmers will be milking as long as they can because of the higher payout. A farmer has been talking to meat processors who say they are expecting a flood of cull cows in May. The beef schedule is 15 cents a kilo ahead of last year.
Across the Cook Strait, and Nelson has had another wet week. It's been a very kind season with plenty of grass to keep the cows happy. Farmers are making sure they're all set for winter, ensuring pastures ahead of stock, doing maintenance and having a think about mistakes from this season and how can they avoid them next season. One farmer says it's been one of those seasons where everything's just gone to plan. In Marlborough, it's a different story. Things are still dry and it's starting to get cold when most would prefer a warm autumn, which would give a bit more growth before winter. Farmers are trying their best to keep their animals fed, but difficult choices around buying feed or destocking are being made. Some areas are in their second dry year and it's starting to take a toll. Our contact wants others to take good care of their health and well-being, get off farm if they can, or give Rural Support Trust a bell for a confidential chat. He says they need to know they won't be judged for putting their hand up and saying they're doing it tough.
The West Coast's been damp. A little rain was needed, but the heavy falls can stop. More fine days are on order now. On dairy farms, cull cows are being sent off to the works. If the weather allows and it doesn't get too soggy underfoot, some farmers will try to milk to the end of May. The dry continues in Canterbury, with farms in the east the driest. For some, the dry conditions are forcing tough decisions. It's a real shame as the temperatures are warm and if moisture was around, grass would grow. Many farmers are trying to get rid of the last of their lambs and cattle before winter. Processors are battling with a lack of shipping containers to put product in.
South Otago is becoming uncomfortably dry. There's been no significant rain for 7 or 8 weeks now. A millimetre here and there has been enough to give pastures a green tinge. Paddocks really need some growth before winter arrives. Winter crops like swedes, fodder beet and kale won't yield well unless they have a drink. Baleage is already being fed to sheep. The rams have done their stuff and farmers are now waiting for a good May. Southland's had the odd hot day and then the fires had to be lit. A good dollop of rain has arrived. The farmer we called says they plan to milk until the 27th of May but have cut down to once a day milking to keep the weight on cows. Milk production is nice and steady.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Over the past couple of years on Country Life, we've spoken to a few farmers who have launched clothing labels for garments made with the wool they produce, mainly in response to crashing wool prices. Today we're meeting Sophie and Sam Hurley, a young farming couple who have branched out. They are producing accessories made of wool.
So we do overnight bags, shopping, our casual shopper, tote bags in a couple of different sizes, what we call our everyday bag. Caps, wallets, laptop sleeves, dog products.
The Hurley's Honest Wolf range has been on the market for less than a year, but already thousands of items have been picked up by their friendly rural postie and taken from the remote family farm deep in the Turakina Valley to be sent on to customers in New Zealand and overseas. We'll come back to the wool venture soon, but first a bit about the farm. It's a towering Rangitike sheep station. You'll find it half an hour from Hunterville, long after the seal gives way to gravel. In the other direction, it's a narrow, windy 50-minute drive to Taihape. Whichever way you choose, you pass picture postcard wool sheds and grand old homesteads. I met Sam in his shed beside the wool press.
All up, we have about 25,000 breeding ewes, and all of their progeny is raised and finished by ourselves.
So you've got a couple of farms up this valley?
There's two up here, but all up Papanui Estate sort of runs about just over 5,000 hectares. So that ranges from breeding country down to finishing country, yeah.
How many did you say, 25,000 breeding ewes?
Yes, yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it keeps us pretty busy, and it's good fun, yeah.
This really is heartland sheep country, isn't it? It's so steep through here.
Yeah, it's good, healthy papa country. The animals do really well out here. And it grows out a well-rounded lamb to go down to our finishing countries in Cheltenham.
So you couldn't fatten them here, really? It's the pasture's just not good enough?
Yeah, like all these pastures are native pastures, and so when this lamb was cleared, these have been the same grasses that would have been thrown on by hand by the farmers back then, so they don't have the grunt that these new pastures provide on the finishing country with the clovers and all the new science that have gone into all these new pastures to grow a good animal out.
Is this horse country?
Yes, yep. All of the stock work is done on horse. I think mainly for a safety reason, like at least if you're mustering and you're working your dogs and you're looking at the sheep, then at least you know that you've got an animal that's looking where it's going, not like if you're driving a four-wheeler. You're in control of that. And we have a broodmare team here of about 10 and with a stallion. So we also breed all our own horses and raise them, and they're broken in at 3-year-old. So they've spent their life on these hills and they know their way around.
How many staff do you have?
All up. We've probably got a team of about a dozen. And they range from junior shepherds to stock managers, generals.
You've got a full-time cook?
Yeah, and she looks after three boys up the road, and she gives them smoko lunch and dinner, and will pack them a lunch if they're going to be away for the day, and yeah, does the grocery shopping for them and make sure their cupboards are full for the weekends. I think the cook shop is very important for the young staff that we have, because in the summer here, we can do some big hours, and so it's nice to know that they can go home, and if they need some time to train their dogs, they've got the time to do that without having to prepare a meal. And relax and have a beer and know that they're going to wake up with a full tummy and back into it the next day.
So we're looking at lots of fadges in here.
You've been doing a little bit of shearing. Yeah, we've just finished for the season.
You were saying before that some of the wool is contracted. Do you know around about how much a kilo you're getting these days for wool?
Yeah, it's not that good.
I've heard under $1 a kilo.
Yeah, well, some of it can more than likely be under $1. And some of the contracted that has hit the right specifications has sort of around that $1.50 to $2.
Is it costing you to shear your sheep?
Last financial was our first year in the Hurley farming history that it became a cost rather than an income.
How long has your family been farming?
My grandfather bought the first property in 1952.
And in the 50s, wool would have been in hot demand.
Yeah, in those times, wool was a very major part of the income, even to the point that there were decisions made whether or not to ram the ewes because they grow better wool if they're not growing a lamb inside them. Now, obviously, meat is our major income, and wool is now at a cost.
And that's exactly why Honest Wolf was born.
So Honest Wolf, we wanted a bit of a fashionable name to go with our brand. So the honest part of it came from using honest materials. So we use our wool off the farm, grown right here, and farming sustainably and about, following all health guidelines. And we're pretty open with how we farm. And then the wolf side of things, we introduced that part to be the leader among the pack and using wool in alternative ways, I guess. When I say we want it to be a fashionable name is we want the urban consumer to relate to the name.
Yeah, we didn't want it to be associated with just like a woolen bag. You know, we sort of wanted it to be...
It could be anything.
It could be anything, yeah.
There's so many options with wool, with things you can make, and we just didn't want to limit ourselves with the potential.
Sophie had been mulling over what else could be done with their wool for a long time.
I used to drive into work every day for 5 years, which took about an hour and a quarter one way. So I had a lot of thinking time. And in 2018, plastic bags were getting banned from the country. So on our honeymoon, actually, we started talking about alternative options because there needed to be a replacement option. And we started talking about then that we could bring in a plastic bag alternative using the qualities that wool has.
And we just thought this was a perfect little stepping stone to try and add value to our wool clip. And it had all the properties that fitted a shopping bag, thermoregulate and strong.
Keeps your groceries cold. So yeah. We've got a long drive to in and out to the grocery store. It probably takes about an hour one way. And so we just thought, with a reusable shopping bag, the qualities of wool has, it would keep your milk cold.
Mm. And does it?
It does.
And at the end of the day, it's biodegradable.
Sophie started playing around with the design of that first bag and then started adding other products to the mix. She says quite a lot has happened in 3 years.
Yeah, lots happened amongst that, having a baby as well. So it's all been a rather busy time, which is how we like it. So yeah.
And we've been lucky that we've actually only been selling for 8 months. And so through that, a lot of product has been leaving the shelves, and so we've been able to quickly develop every product, and so that's been awesome. Adding leather or changing handles, constantly improving them, so that's been really nice. And we've had, through social media, we've been able to involve the consumer, asking them what colours they'd like, what they'd like to see in their bags, e.g. Drink bottle holders or other bits and pieces.
We probably didn't do what businesses normally do and start off with one product and see how it goes. We kind of just took the risk and designed a range of products.
After the sheep have been relieved of their wool, it heads to Napier to be scoured.
And then from there, goes up to Auckland on a ship over to India, manufactured, dyed over in India, and then comes back in this final product back to the farm.
So how it works is that we've got an agent over there and he deals with all the manufacturing, different people that are required. So our felting, our dyeing, our person who we get our zips from. And so we just talk directly with him. So it's quite easy. We actually just talk mostly on WhatsApp every night. It's a pretty simple process.
These are all made by machine.
So people don't sit at a sewing machine and make these?
No.
No. So it's filtered.
Made by machines. That's why it could be done here if we brought in the manufacturing here, which would be the ideal end game. But from our understanding is that that can't be done right now.
Papanui Estate produces about 170 tonnes of wool annually, and each sheep shorn produces enough wool in a year to make 4 Honest Wolf bags.
We've got a long way to make them all into bags, but that's our goal.
The rest of your wool goes, what, into carpet?
Yeah, most of it is into carpet, yeah. That's another thing we've really loved, is seeing the whole 360 of the wool leaving our property and then comes back to the property as these, where originally it left our property in a 190-kilo wolf edge and we didn't really have any connection to where it was going.
Every sale that goes out, I wrote a handwritten note to everyone. So some orders we could be sending out 30 a day and they would all be getting a handwritten note, and that's something I want to carry on, because without them we wouldn't be able to keep selling. So,
what do you say?
Thank you. On our card itself, it says thank you, E-W-E, wherever they're from. I said, we'll hopefully have a good adventure with wherever this bag may take you, and thank you for supporting the wool industry and share the goodness of wool. It's awesome that they've been part of it. Yeah, so these are our kids' caps with a little wolf on the front, and then we've got our adult caps as well, and a big selling point in these adult caps have been to corporates. So in the replace of their canvas cap that many companies use, we have been able to offer them a New Zealand wool cap with, and we can organise for their own logo to go on the front. So we've for Silverfern Farms, for example, have bought a couple hundred caps off us, and all their agents wear them. Carfields are the same, PGG Seeds, well, various companies. So it's been great to, and they all work in the ag industry and now wearing wool every day. So,
are there any other products in the pipeline?
We've got various ideas, and it's just about containing those ideas and adding additional colours and additional products as time goes by. But just want to get these ones right first and see how we go. Yeah.
And you do dog collars and leashes.
Yeah, we introduced dog collars and dog leads as a way to use leftover wool from other products. So we wanted to not waste anything. So our wool from our everyday bag, for example, is put into our dog collars and dog leads.
Have you had any feedback about them?
Yeah, I think they've been going well so far. But, it was an interesting game to get into. It's quite different to everything else that we're doing, but the more wool, the better, right? Yeah.
Sophie and Sam Hurley. And in an effort to really tell their story, the lining of the bags is printed with a map of the farm, complete with named paddocks. They also use some leather, but despite wanting to use their own, they've been told it's not possible at the moment. As well as 25,000 sheep, the Hurley family also farm 1,400 steers.
And now we're off to the South Island. Levi Harrison is a modern hunter-gatherer in Golden Bay. He and his partner, Annika Corsten, have mastered the necessary primitive skills to not only survive, but thrive in nature. Cosmo Kentish Barnes meets them on a path beside a creek and asks Levi how his journey began.
I was born in New Zealand, left New Zealand when I was 3 and a half or so, went to Germany and lived in a city most of my life. There was a time, preschool, when I was, in nature quite a bit. And I remember that as a really beautiful time. And then, I was in a city and I knew that something's wrong for me, that I didn't feel completely well. And it took me a long, long time till I really listened to that voice. And together with my then wife, we made the decision to move, to leave Germany. And here in New Zealand, I was immediately confronted with a completely different reality. I feel like nature was infiltrating me with a new message.
Did it feel like you were coming home, even though you'd left at such a young age?
Yeah, I remember at customs, the woman said, "Welcome home," and that's how it feels. And it's also a deeper layer of home. For me, it's connecting with my roots, also like into the past, where we are coming from as hunter-gatherers. Because, that's where we all come from. That's our shared background.
And talking about hunting and gathering, Annika is beside us skinning a hare that you've shot today.
Last night, yeah.
How did you end up here with Levi?
I had been in New Zealand before, actually, in 2004, for a couple of weeks. And when I left, I was sitting at Christchurch Airport and had a sense in my body that I wanted to come back. Mm. And I went back to Germany studying and made some magic possible and came over for studying in New Zealand and ended up in Dunedin. And since then, I haven't looked back. Yeah.
What were you studying?
I studied botany at the University of Otago. Yeah.
And Levi, you've been living essentially in nature, for two or three years now?
Yeah, I think it's a bit more than 3 years. That was also a journey, like, how do I really want to live? It started out moving Germany, central heating to an off-grid place, so solar cells and heating with wood, to then a caravan in the middle of the bush. And then I recognized I want to live closer to nature, even closer than I was in the caravan. I wanted to live on the ground and decided to live in a teepee. Did that for a year, a good year on my own, and then Annika and Kawa moved in. And so the three of us were living in a teepee for another year. And for me, living on the ground in the dirt, it freed something in me. I mean, there's a lot less to clean, that's for sure.
Did you make your beds out of what you could find in the bush?
I found some mamaku dried up, so just, half dead. That were kind of the sides of the bed. Found some manuka twigs and put, I think, two wool blankets on top, and that was my bed. Then, with Annika moving in, we added a bit of straw, so it was a bit more comfortable. And the two of us in the bed was just so much warmer, and Kawa was in there as well, so, yeah. Second year already was no problem at all.
And was that here in the bush, close to where we are sitting now?
Yeah, exactly. Just up, 5 minutes, just up the hill. And this creek here is where we wash, so it's 20 meters from here. That's our shower. And, I mean, who's got a shower with fish in it?
Yeah.
Even in the winter, you would wash in the creek.
Yeah,
especially that would be quite
winter.
Refreshing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the morning, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
Good start to the day.
Do your days revolve around finding food? Because you rely on nature, don't you, to feed you?
Yeah, it's a central part in our lives, for sure. So when I started out, I was quite efficient with food, which meant I would just go get a lot of greens, but, I mean, that's not a lot of work. I don't have to grow them, I just have to pick them. And I bow hunt a lot of goats, and so I would eat that, basically greens and goat meat. Later added some fish, but there was not a lot of variety. And with Annika coming into my life, yeah, she is adding a lot of variety to our diet, which is great. And that also means a lot more time going into it. Yeah, for sure.
I love the invitation that you used, finding, because, sometimes it's not so much actually going out and go let's see what's out there. It actually is there. So it's like walking with open eyes through the day and noticing. And then there's just so much, and new things, and the plants change. And out of the blue, the fennel plant has produced some seeds rather than flower heads. So it's presenting itself in a way. Mm.
Do you grow things as well as foraging for edibles?
Yeah, so I grow a few things. I'm noticing in myself that I'm steering away from it a little bit, the sort of maintenance of a garden, because there's so much abundance around me that I don't have to work for. But I do grow some potatoes, some pumpkins, and some greens. Things like a pepino plant, for example, are just having some treats that don't normally grow in the wild.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you do need to buy?
There's nothing we need to buy, but there are things that we like to buy. It's also a fact that we live a modern life as well, and so we've got chores in modern life that prevent us from just being outside 24/7. So it's kind of nice to buy a few things, and some things are really tasty, like olive oil, for example. I just enjoy that. Yeah,
or eating some cheese sometimes.
A treat!
Yeah, for sure.
Do you buy things like loo paper?
No,
I haven't done that for a long time.
No, yeah. We use water, so the Asian method. There is water here, and we use that, and it feels really good.
I did this game before, and I came up with an average of what we're spending per week, and it's probably about $20 per person each week. And we, as Lima just said, we're part of, how did you call it?
Modern life?
A modern life,
yes.
Yeah. And so there's still fees we pay, rent, I still have a car because I work in town once a week. So yeah, there's still things where we spend money and where we need to earn a little bit of money to participate.
Do you have children?
I have children, yeah. I've got two. They live in town now.
Are they quite interested in the way you both live?
Not so much. So I'm Lee, my daughter. She's quite keen. So she likes to go bush. She likes to look for mushrooms. And she knows quite a few plants now. My boy, he's more into modern culture things. And I just need to accept that. And that's totally okay.
Yes. At the moment, what sort of edibles are you finding? What sort of food are you bringing home every day from walks in the forest?
At the moment, a lot of mushrooms.
Really?
So they're starting to pop up, yes, and lots of different ones. Yeah. So we just fry them in the frying pan and eat them like that, and we've dried them before as well. And then, there's various greens. So we find fennel still, as I said earlier. There's various other things like chicory, sorrel. On the land, we've got a lot of fruit trees. So we're obviously also still eating domesticated fruits.
Yep.
Possums, lots of possums are around. So in terms of edibles, like at this time of the year, because we've got so many fruit trees, we've got lots of possums coming from the forest. So that's a really good food source for us and the dog. So
yes. Oh, do you eat possum?
Yes,
yeah.
We do.
What does that taste like?
It's a bit gamey, for sure, but it's the cleanest meat that you can eat. They spend all their time in the bush and eat all those good things. So, no, it's really good.
What is the best recipe that you know for cooking a possum?
If someone was to get hold of some possum, I would try to get a slow cooker and basically cook it like similar to how you would cook a coq au vin. So you might want to add some red wine to that and then some spices, herbs that you've got in your garden or some herbs that you can find, some wild edibles, and then maybe add some tomatoes if they're in season, maybe some potatoes, and then just slow cook that for probably 3 to 6 hours or something like that, and then you will have a nice stew afterwards.
Lovely dinner.
Mm. Here you go.
Now, what's this called again? This
is a Himalayan honeysuckle.
Mmm. Bitter but sweet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In terms of hunting, how long did it take before you were able to shoot a bow well enough to be able to kill an animal?
It took me a few months of dedicated training. And I'm really enjoying it. Living off the land and eating off the land is amazingly connecting. And having been by myself in the bush for like 2 weeks, just didn't take any food, just my knife and my bow, I recognized that I'm part of this. Just getting up with the sun, seeing the birds come in, feed, seeing the goats come in, feed, leave again, and me just being part of this cycle of life.
It must be quite exciting, heading off into the bush for weeks.
Yeah, I thought it would be this huge challenge, so for 3 days I was waiting for it to be yeah, the survival challenge, and it just never happened. After some time, I recognized, oh, there's nothing to do. And even that wasn't so much of a challenge, because I just watched the clouds, I watched the ants, I watched the birds, felt the wind, and yeah, stopped thinking so much. My mind became quiet, and there's a good chance if I didn't have kids that I'd just go bush, and at least for a few years, yeah, would live like that.
Yes. Could you do that, Annika? Go bush for a few years?
Thank you for the question. I had an impulse to add to that. So, yeah, what was alive in me is that I now know that this wouldn't be a big challenge for me, because it's been a gradual process towards getting to that point. So, yeah, there's something in my body that has this trust that, yeah, I can just be. I can be with myself. I can be with Levi. I have a longing for actually doing that. We've been talking about this.
And all in all, how would you sum up your lives here, living in such a basic way, really, in a tent in the bush?
It's lovely, and we enjoy it. And it feels really natural.
Mm, yeah.
It's kind of hard talking about it, really, because this is our life. This is how we do it every day. And we stopped thinking about the fact that this is quite different to how other people live. So for us, this is just how we live. And yeah, it's great. I didn't want to live any different. Yeah.
I think one of the things that I find really exciting about stripping your life down to some simplicity, it gives you the opportunity to choose. So once you've gone down to the bare bones and to the simple things that you need in life, you can then choose what to add and not to add. And it provides a sense of freedom.
Hunter-gatherers Annika Corsten and Levi Harrison chatting with Cosmo in the bush somewhere in Golden Bay.
Hi, I'm Clint Meyer from Fire Dragon Chilies in the far north, and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
The landscape at Wharepapa South near Te Awamutu is striking. It's dotted with ignimbrite rocks, formed 1,800 years ago when Lake Taupō erupted and the ash and pumice that was shot into the air melded into rock. The rocks themselves seem to erupt out of the lush rolling paddocks. Some resemble cliffs or towers and are used for rock climbing. Others are much smaller, giving shelter to stock and headaches to fences. It's here that 32-year-old Andrew Wellington farms a few hundred sheep and dairy grazers and 4,000 deer.
This is some view.
It is, but I look at it every day, so I'm used to it.
I was saying to you before how beautiful it is and how you must never get sick of it, but you said you don't always see the beauty, you see what needs to be done.
That's right, yes.
Always something to be done.
Oh, yeah. So we've been working the land for 100 years. The first 4 years, my great-grandfather leased the land, and then he brought the first bit of the block 95 years ago.
When did you take over the farm?
I've been back coming up 4 years now. The reason I came home was because my father was sick with cancer, so I came back just to give a hand and help out and start learning what happened and how things happened. And I stayed.
Had your dad been in deer a long time?
Yeah, Dad started deer farming when deer farming started in New Zealand. So they caught deer out of the bush and brought them back here and farmed them here. He was originally had quite a lot of sheep on here, and when the sheep were at a high and the deer were at a low, he was selling one sheep and buying two deer, so he increased his numbers.
And that was in the early 2000s?
Yeah.
When you were young, did you take much interest in what your father was doing?
Yeah, I was out here as much as I could. I was always wanting to go up the farm after school, but I had to do my homework and my jobs before I could do anything, so I went as fast as I could.
Have you got some deer up the way here?
Yeah, we can go and look at some deer. I've got plenty of them.
Andrew's taking me to Mount Cook, the highest paddock on the farm. It's autumn, and that means it's the roar. The stags are in with most of the hinds.
They're always roaring. We got one that started about the 10th of January, I heard them, so that's relatively early. Yeah, I enjoy listening to them. I'll come up here at night and just listen to them sometimes, because we don't have any close to the house.
And what's the difference between an elk roar and a red stag roar?
Red stags sound a lot deeper and more of a roar, whereas the elks are, well, they call it a bugle, so it's more of a squeal. One will go and then someone else will go and someone will call back. So.
Andrew has a velvet-based red deer herd, so the goal is to produce decent weights of quality velvet. Red stags are used over red hinds for all the breeding animals, and some of his top hinds are artificially inseminated. He also puts meatier, bugling elk or wapiti stags with another mob, and their progeny goes to the works. However, the per kilogram price of venison has plummeted recently, partly driven by a lack of demand. Lockdowns have meant fewer people have been dining out in Europe.
Oh, from the high, which was 2 years ago, at $14, we're down to about $5 now.
That's huge.
Mm.
So how do you roll with that?
It does make it tough, especially when you're in a dry season. You've still got to feed them, and especially when the prices are low, it makes it hard. But you've just got to keep doing it, because that's what farming's about, really.
So last year, not only were prices tumbling, but we had a shocking drought. So you would have been paying quite a bit for extra feed?
Yeah, we brought in 1,000 tonne of feed.
And in dollar terms, what would that be?
I didn't actually work it out. I was too scared to. Just paid the bill.
Andrew says thankfully, though, velvet prices have been steady. A couple of years ago, a kilogram of velvet was worth $130. Now it's around $110, which is still pretty good. Andrew says his 1,000 mixed-age stags have been producing, on average, 7 kilograms of velvet each.
That's what I really enjoy, is cutting velvet and seeing how our genetics are going and whether we're doing the right or the wrong thing.
You're looking to see whether each year you're gaining more and more velvet from the one animal, are you?
Yes. So their first proper cut of velvet is as a two-year-old, and that's where you get to judge how good they are.
I wonder if you could roll the clock back and think of when your dad first started cutting velvet off two-year-olds. I wonder what the weight difference is in the velvet.
Well, I can remember back to when he cut his first 6 kilo stag. He was so delighted. I was there helping him in the deer shed. That was probably 20 years ago. It was the best he'd ever cut. And now we're averaging 6 kilos on our first cut for our main mob.
Today, what would make you jump with joy like your father did?
Well, this year, our best stag cut 24 kilos of velvet. That made me jump. I'm just thinking, well, in 20 years, is my whole herd going to be doing that?
Andrew's involved in deer research. He's been part of a project looking at pain responses to velveting. Stags are given a local anaesthetic when velvet is removed. In the study, long-acting painkillers were trialled.
So they gave the pain relief at velveting and then monitored them after velveting to see if there was a difference.
Is this as well as the local?
As well as the local, yes.
And what did you see?
No difference with the straight local compared to the long-acting pain relief.
Was that a bit of a surprise?
Yeah, you would have thought that, well, if they've had pain relief that lasts a lot longer, that you would have got a different response. But obviously they get over that velveting quite quickly and it doesn't really affect them too much.
Andrew says the stags had little readers, cable tied to their ear tags and also one between their coronets, to monitor how much they flicked their ears and shook their heads, movements that would typically be associated with discomfort. The stags were also watched carefully for 12 hours after the velvet was cut.
Because Andrew's set on improving the amount of velvet his stags produce, he keeps his eyes out for new stags that could introduce superior genetics to his herd. However, he admits he seldom buys one.
So we find that if we buy stags from the South Island, they don't perform the same up here. Just because where we are, we've got a lot of other challenges that they don't have.
Like?
Like eczema and ticks. They never seem to come up here and do the same as what they were doing down south. So we tend to select animals from our own herd to do most of our breeding. We will try different animals, like with our AI program, we'll have a little bit of something else mixed in to try to see if it works in our herd.
If you needed to go out and buy a decent stag, how much would you have to pay?
You're looking at paying $120,000 for a stag that is doing a reasonable amount better than what we can breed.
So what jobs do you have to do this afternoon?
Oh, feeding out.
They let you into the paddock with them happily enough?
Yep, they do. I hang a piece of plastic up on the gateways, which stops them from coming out. They don't like that flapping plastic. And then it means I don't have to jump out and shut the gate behind me.
Was that one of your dad's tricks?
It was, yep.
So we're going to go into the paddock on the tractor and see if they'll come up close for a photo opportunity.
Oh, they will.
They'll think it's dinner time.
Yeah, they think they're getting fed, so they'll come up.
They'll be so disappointed.
They will be, but they've already been fed today, so they just think they're getting a bit extra.
Is there room for me?
There is. Flash tractor, this one. It's got a cab.
And air conditioning?
Yep, but you do need it when you're spending probably 12 hours a day feeding out.
Is that how much you spend? Well, between you and the people who work here?
Yes.
Wow.
At the moment, anyway, when we're this short of feed.
Well, you must be better off for feed this year than you were last.
Oh, miles better off, yeah. Yeah, last year it was sort of an 18-hour day job. He will be the more dominant stag at the moment, so he's just trying to find out where everyone else is to, and he'll chase them away if they come up.
Do you have more than one in a mob?
Yes, so with this mob there's about 250 hinds in this mob, so there's 10 stags in here.
Much fighting between them?
There is a bit, but not a huge amount.
You've got to be a bit careful of stags, don't you?
You do. At this time of the year, they're in their raw period where they get more aggressive, so you've just got to be aware of them. Like, most of them are pretty good. They wouldn't hurt you. Well, they may threaten a little bit, but they won't do anything. But you never know. You just got to be very wary of them when you're around them. I do have one that, well, the kids have called him Rory, because you go up to the fence and he'll run up and down the fence roaring at you, telling you to keep away. Uh-huh. So you've got to be careful of him.
He's kind of patrolling.
He is, yep. He tries to keep all his hinds together. And yeah, he just chased that other fella away. Well, the other fella knew who was boss, so he sort of disappeared pretty quickly.
The other fella, you want him to do some work as well. So when will he get the chance?
When he gets tired, someone else will push him out of the road and start doing the work.
And then once he's had a bit of a rest, he'll take the dominant spot again?
More than likely, yep.
He's just patrolling backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards.
Yep.
Must be exhausting.
It is. They tend to lose a lot of weight at this time of the year. One, because they're busy patrolling and not eating, and they're just working hard.
Do you have any wild stags around here?
Yeah, we do. We normally get one a year turn up on the boundary, so we've got to deal with that so they don't get in with the herd and injure or kill the other stags.
Because they'd have their antlers.
The wild ones will have antlers on, which is basically a weapon. So you've got two stags out in front of us here now.
It's fascinating to watch.
Oh, it is, yeah.
It's been hours.
Yeah, I do. I work with them full time and I still enjoy watching them.
Deer farmer Andrew Wellington. And Carol did get close enough to take some photos there on our webpage.
And that's where we have to leave you for another week. If you didn't get to hear last week's programme, do jump onto our webpage and push the play button. Until next week, bye now.
Bye.